The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinions. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In order to carry out policy of this lodge, of the ULT, this lodge has a program that is composed of several varieties of activities. Each Sunday morning from 11 until 12 noon, there is usually a talk, a forum, or a panel. And these are based on a particular theme for the month. And the theme for May is psychism and spiritualism, spirituality. The first talk this morning is Buddha, the Spiritual Light of Asia. And for next Sunday, the presentation will be on Should Psychic Powers Be Developed? Now, following all these presentations, there's always a time for questions, answers, and comments. Now, on the third Friday of each month, there is a presentation on at a time when the students compare religions and philosophies. Now, this class also carries a theme, and that theme is the message of symbolism. And so for May the 21st, the subject of that presentation is going to be the triangle and the star. Now this class began promptly at 7 o'clock and lasts for 1 hour. The doors to the lodge are open at 6:30. Now this lodge maintains a reference library which is open each Wednesday from 5:30 until 7:30. And there you will find straight theosophical literature consisting of books, pamphlets, and magazines, all comprising the original writings of the founders of the theosophical movement. These may be read for free, actually, in the library, but should you desire to purchase some for your own home study, you may do that at the desk located just outside of the library. Now, the library closes at 7:30 on Wednesdays, and at 7:45 there is a class in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. But because of a special meeting this coming Wednesday, this ocean class will be postponed until Wednesday the 9th. That special meeting is White Lotus Day. And this is a time when students around the world assemble to pay tribute to Madam H.P. Blavatsky, who was one of the founders of the Theosophical movement. Now, our program here will consist of an introduction, selected readings, and a talk entitled H.P. Blavatsky and Theosophy. Now, because this is a special meeting, we are requesting that those who plan to attend will try to arrive at least 10 minutes before the hour and be quietly seated in order to affect the proper tone for what is to follow. Now, all activities of this lodge are free, and these are made possible by voluntary contributions of time, of service, and money, and all are most welcome to participate. The reading this morning, in line with the talk, is excerpt from The Light of Asia by Sir Edwin Arnold. Even while he mused on the Bodhi tree, glorified with the conquest gained for all, and lightened by a light greater than day's, then he arose, radiant, rejoicing, strong, beneath the tree, and lifting his high voice, spake this in hearing of all times and worlds. Many a house of life hath held me, seeking ever him who wrought these prisons of the senses, sorrow fraught. Some was my ceaseless strife. The books say well, my brothers, each man's life the outcome of his former living is. The bygone wrongs breed forth sorrows and woes. The bygone right breeds bliss. So is the eightfold path which brings to peace. By lower or by upper heights it goes. The firm soul hastes, the feeble tarries. All will reach the sunlit snows. Enter the path. There is no grief like hate, no pain like passions, no deceit like sense. Enter the path, for hath he gone whose foot treads down one fond offense. The subject of the talk is Buddha, the spiritual light of Asia.
For those who might not be familiar with the author, he was taken fully with the Buddha. The book is stated The Light of Asia, and he felt that is the Buddha, that it was the Buddha. He feels that in the introduction, he says, this volume is dutifully inscribed to the sovereign, the grand master, and companions of the most exalted order of the Star of India. It only takes up 8 books. And it's really not till he gets to the 8th book that we actually can see the Buddha's teachings. So we wonder, for those who might not be familiar, we can give ourselves some time to have a little background of who and what this Buddha, this spiritual light of Asia, was and how he came about. Keep in mind now, this character, this individual, this exalted one, all this took place when he was born, 620 BC. We are talking about an individual and the story about his life, 623 years before the Christian era. We will find, as we go through here, a lot of symbols that we know here in the West that we thought were unique with the Christian era and time. We will find out this was prior, much prior. He passed from the physical body in 543 BC at 80 years of age. And his teachings, which we call Buddha Dharma, we need to have individuals understand it was not a religion, but a moral philosophy, a philosophy that could be put into everyday life. He was a prince. His father was a king. His mother was a queen. He was brought into this earth in an area which we could call on the borders, the northern borders of Nepal. And the idea of Siddhartha being his name, Gautama, this is his family line. As a child, he had such a natural, shall we say, wisdom that seemed that he understood all the arts and sciences that his teachers could pronounce on him. And this started in depth around the age of 8, between 7 and 8. And it seems that even though he could do all this and understand all this, it was without study. And even his teachers couldn't understand. There was nothing that they really couldn't express to him for understanding that it would seem, well, he comprehended it immediately. I understand it means such and such and such and such. So even at the young age of 8, there was a character showing through that for most children at that age wasn't coming through. There was a love and an understanding of the world and the beauty that he saw and the peace that he saw, which this is very interesting. As we go through it, we will find out. As a young child, it was one thing. His mother had had a vision in a dream that told her that the infant that you will have will eventually be another Buddha. There have been lines of Buddhas that have come down through history. Expressing this information, she explained to the king. He thought, well, that's very interesting to know. Because as Siddhartha was growing up, the palace that he lived in was surrounded by high walls. The exterior gates were guarded. Everything that was within this palace, the king had made notices of. I do not want to see a wilted flower. I do not want to see anything of dirt. I only want to see beauty and peace. All animals shall be taken care of here in the palace, which he had an assortment of animals. So that technically, Siddhartha only saw, he was like a prisoner in a way, in the palace. He only saw within those walls what the king wanted him to see, because eventually he would follow in his footsteps. The king was looking out for his next to sit at the throne. So as time went on from youth into the early age of 16, he wanted his son to be mated and married. There was an event. All the beautiful maidens from all over came. Families brought them far and near. But he was really attracted to one. And you will excuse the pronunciation if we can't get it right. Avyasadhara, we think, was her name, princess. And at 16, there was a marriage ceremony to take place. There was a strong feeling of attachment with her. And again, his father gave him palaces, and each palace was of a similar idea. He would not know of the famine, the filth, the death, the decay that was outside the walls of that palace. Each one was set up with the same idea, that all he could really see was beauty. And he never understood, when questioning how life was so beautiful and so kind. And he was very kind-hearted to everyone, not only his fellow friends within her and his king's, shall we say, acquaintances, his officers. There was a kindness to him, down to the littlest servant. He had a way of just being part of whatever he was. He was just a natural lover of beauty, a lover of honesty and truth. This went on for quite a while, because he really had no idea what went on outside the world. And there was a short story where at one time he and one of his cousins were out, and his cousin took an arrow and shot down a bird. The bird falls to the ground, and Siddhartha, not understanding, quickly picks up the bird, puts him in his arm, and somehow pulls the arrow out from him and proceeds to take natural leaves from the garden to put on the wound to try to help it. And as this was going on, his cousin said, "I want the bird. I shot the bird." He said, "You didn't kill the bird." No, he said, "And I killed the bird. You didn't kill the bird. This bird is alive. There is life here." And his idea was that he shouldn't have it. It wasn't his to have. He wanted to see if he could heal it and put it within the gardens. It shouldn't be taken away for that, because it was really shot down not for food, but on a whim. This was an idea that sort of stayed in his mind for quite a while, and he didn't understand. After working on the wound, he actually picked up that arrow and put it into his skin on his hand. That was the first time he really knew pain. To understand it, he didn't, but he felt pain for the first time. And it came to the point where he wanted to see what was outside of this palace. What is there that I can't see? Is it all the same as this? So he finally, after years of debating and thinking, in his 29th year, he actually left the palace, his loving wife, and by then his infant son. And he went off to the jungle, because he thought if he could get the farthest away from the palace and the beauty of the palace, maybe he could see life as it really was, because he did not understand everything could be this way. So he's off in the jungles. He's trying as best he can in deep meditation, and he's trying to undergo different types of discipline. The mortification of the body, the fasting. This was 6 years that he wandered and did this. It then came to the point where this couldn't be the answer. He wasn't getting the answer he wanted. And yet he meditated on many different things. but he still couldn't understand what he did see. He couldn't understand why it was there. Why is this suffering and misery and sorrow here? So to understand it, he wanted to delve into it more. There comes a time in all of his time of trying to search and look where he comes upon a tree and sits down under this tree to rest. And this tree became the tree of his life, the Bodhi tree, because it was here that he went through, shall we say, mental struggles, mental temptations that he had seen now on the outside that he too had a feeling and acquirement for. And it was a test of going through this and understanding it, because that was the one thing he wanted to do of all things, was to be able to not only experience, but to understand it and to know why. And then, if it was of a low nature, a selfish nature, of a painful nature, how do I conquer this? How do I get over it? So between all the different things that he had to go through, for the temptations that he would see in the meditative mode, he worked them out. And it was like, they call it, each night when he would come back to the tree to settle, we'd call it the watch. And he said he saw on the third watch of these nights that he was there a line of all his lives in all the worlds, far back, farther back, and farthest yet, he saw 550 previous lives of how he had lived. There is another term that we use in the Eastern philosophy, that of a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is an individual who has not lived one life in a certain vein, but literally he has lived many, many lives in that one pointedness, that one pointedness of being a help to all humanity. Each life he is born into, he continues to develop. So we call the bodhisattva are those that are on their way to being Buddhas. And he definitely was one. Even though at this life that he had just come in, he wasn't aware of it at the very beginning. Now, he also, once he saw all these and understood what, there is a theme, there is a reason I'm here. It then came on the fourth night that he actually understood the cause of sorrow. And it was in this state of high meditation that he also got a glimmer of his four normal truths, which we will go into later. It was the first time it was brought to light for him to watch. So he understood that. From that came the Noble Eightfold Path. He now understood it. He knew how to walk through it. He wanted to express it to others. At first, some of these, he was a little leery about giving out the ideas because he thought they might be too confusing. And yet it was as simple as, you know, from day to night, just to learn to live it, to walk it. So he had, shall we say, gathered around him for his early teachings, students. So that whole doctrine of his teachings, it tells us, is to cease from all evil actions, to generate all that is good, to cleanse one's mind. And this is where we get with that idea of Dharma. It is the law of righteousness. So these, we could call the missionaries, they were sent out to give out the word. But he told them, let men accept it, or reject it using their will, because that's the only way that the soul grows. And that idea of the will, that free will to choose, to be able to choose what each individual feels is right for them. If we think about it, when we think of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, it does say sort of the same thing. Here are the teachings. Take them, try to put them into your everyday life, and either accept them and try to live by them, or reject them as what knowledge you know at the time. Sounds familiar to us. It sounds very much like the Declaration. So these Four Noble Truths we'd like to go over with so that we can understand it today. The first one is that to acknowledge there is suffering. Two, cause of suffering. What is the cause of it? Three, end of suffering. And four, the path to end suffering. So it's a stepping thing that we have to actually work through. Sometimes we can give out and give up, we think, from the physical level, something we want to change or get rid of in our nature. But yet mentally, we are still attached to it. We have to learn how to detach ourselves from the thing, because it is a thing, and we're all aware of change. We live in a world of change. We cannot say that it does not change. But yet there's one thing that he preached that was within each one, is that knowing that identity within us, that never changes. It sees things from very young to middle age to older age to death to waking to sleeping. It's always conscious. It's always there. Because even when the physical body is asleep and in a quiescent state on a bed, we are we, the thinker. That's what we are. That eternal, immortal thinker. We're on a different plane of consciousness. And we're going through dreams for many. They can say, I had this dream, and then I had another dream, and I had another dream. Another individual might say, I never dream. Science tells us even today, we all dream. It's remembering them. So the connection there with that number four, that path to end suffering, he comes forth with his teachings. Now these are all things that he actually, within himself, learn to go through to understand them. Those Noble Eightfold Path, which is helping us to understand how. The first one is right view. Now, as to the law of causation, we would say, in other words, karma. The right view of what karma is in connection with each one of us. Right thought, right speech. Right conduct, again, deals with action. How we live out our day, how we interlive out our day with individuals. These are all these teachings, when you think how far back they've been around, and they're still around. Right livelihood, well, that's speaking of what one's occupation might be, or their vocation, or their discipline, that idea of right livelihood. Right effort. Whatever effort we put forth in any menu or venue is it the right thing to do? Is it balanced? Is it harmonious? Is it for the all, or is it just a selfish notion for oneself? Then we come to right mindfulness. That deals with self-discipline, and that is one of the things that he found quite difficult, but once one gets used to the idea of being our own creator and our own destroyer, that it's us. So we have that idea of self-discipline. I don't need an outside to help me know how to do things. I can do it for myself. And then the last one was right concentration, and that deals of thought, of how one thinks. For those others who want to get more involved, he has the Dhammapada. Now, a lot of people open this up and they say, why does it say, you read the first paragraph and then the second paragraph's the same thing? It's called the twin verses. That the first time you read it or see it or hear it, it's like a fog. But then you do it again and it sort of seeps through that fog and you go, aha. So everything in that whole section deals with all these different things to deal with in everybody's natural life. He deals with sadness, he deals with happiness, he deals with old age, he deals with youth. The wise man, that one that is still ignorant of knowledge, it has many different understandings that even though when we think when it first came out and through the ages, we as a human race really haven't changed that much. We have those same yearnings, those same desires, those same temptations, those same loves and hates that humanity has had for quite a long time. So that it is a philosophy that's not dead like a dead language. It's a philosophy of life. It's a moral standing that each one of us can take and use at any time we decide to choose. And as was stated, there are, for some, the idea of a bodhisattva at that time. They're not all men, and when we say men, we mean a mixture of humanity. Not all men are made up in nature to eventually work to be a Buddha. But it stands from his saying that each one can be a balance and a harmony within himself that he can express to others on a daily basis. Each one can learn a perfectibility. It is, all the germs are within us. We can learn that perfectibility in any area, but we have to put the effort through ourselves. We have to walk that path ourselves. So his great teachings are still around today. Anyone can take advantage of them. Anyone can take it and try to understand. And as he says in one of the sections, so is the eightfold path which brings to peace by lower or by upper heights it goes. The firm soul hast, the feeble tarries. All will reach the sunlit snows. So maybe each one's path is not exactly the same, but he's saying that the end results can be the same, that each one can know and understand and make that change within their life and make them understand in a larger sense why we're here in any one lifetime. It's obviously that if we look at life as a big school, and we're here for lessons to be learned. And it's obvious from what he had to go through and those after him that until the lesson is learned, it will come back. That universal law of karma. The causes have been set up. The reactions will come. And until we get the balance and the understanding of it and the harmony, it will continue to come until it comes to a point where something will come to us that used to bother us so many times. In only one lifetime we can see this. And then all of a sudden, once we've learned to understand it, it now can come to us and it's like a flick of a wrist. It's here and gone. It doesn't matter. It doesn't bother me. I understand it. So these great teachings of this Buddha, his lifetime, and the fact that at one point in all the years of his teachings, that he does come back to his family. He comes back, and who comes? Disciples, his wife, his cousin, the king. Maya, his mother, is no longer here in physical form. And even his little son, Raula, become disciples of this great teaching. And the fact that he could bring it back to the family and have them understand that the great love has never left him, that he felt and knew for his family, his wife, his child. There is great joy in bringing this gift to them. So anyone who has heard of Buddhism, has knows of those who are Buddhists, maybe understand how they look at life. Because if we look at this whole idea of Buddhism, never was any bloodshed ever in connection with Buddhism as far as wars and battles in the fact of making one belief. They have a way of looking at life differently than most people do here in the West. And the Eastern teachings have spread because when you think he started in one little area close to Nepal, that this whole Buddhistic teachings have spread all over this whole globe, from not just the East and the West, the North and the South, that there are Buddhists everywhere. And it is a calmer way of living. It is a way of backing off and being able to observe. He gives us all the steps. We just have to keep trying to do them until we finally say, I got it. I can do this. And then the best one can do is to give to others. So this is briefly that spiritual light that came out of Asia, the Buddha. Maybe you have some questions and comments on the life. Yes?
Yes. This is the United Lodge of Theosophy. Why is it so much emphasis on the Buddha? What relation does Buddha have with the Theosophy?
What relation does Buddha have with Theosophy? Well, when we look at the idea, Theosophia, Greek, divine wisdom. The wisdom that we have in the teachings that we have today from HPB, Robert Crosby, William Q. Judge, these are Eastern ideas and teachings that have been brought and spread to the West. So the same teachings that the Buddha was giving out, Theosophy is just a small part of this ancient teaching. It is the same type of expression. So there is a large closeness to this idea of Theosophy today, and who knows what it was called then, and Buddhism, and especially the Buddhist teachings. Now we must remember, there is the Northern and the Southern teachings. The Buddhist teachings deal more with the Southern teaching. No, the Northern teachings, I get it. The Northern teachings, which are more of a moralistic type of a teaching, of a philosophy, versus the other. But even though they have the two split groups, there are places where they are bridged together. Yes.
In the Buddhist teachings today, there is a lot of ritual that takes place. And you had stated that the Buddha taught philosophy, per se. Now, where did this ritual come from? Was that developed after the Buddha? Did he teach that? Or?
In today's world, the rituals of the times that are there that are being used now were not used back then at the time. This is something that came with the further development. And the type of, quote, rituals that might have been back then had a completely different meaning and understanding. So much of it tends to get brought down to the personal level, not the universal type level. So a lot of that comes, we can see it in just regular religions, how one thing starts from another and then it gets developed and then it gets developed and then it becomes a ritual, but not necessarily did it have its groundings from the original. Yes.
So when you're using the word develop, are you saying that the Buddha improved his teachings across time, or are you saying that modern man created ritual and creed and dogma as an offshoot
from it,
of the original?
Yes, from the original it was added on, and as we stated, one can see that how many different religions do we have today here in the West alone. It's man's putting his touch to it and bringing it down to the personal level. The universal level does not account for that at all. Yes?
I think there's a very good analogy between Buddhism and Christianity. When Jesus was teaching, he was simply teaching people to, what he needed the people to know. But the church developed all the, what grew out of Jesus' teaching is the Christian church, which is
right.
Eastern church, Western church, many, many different denominations. And in Buddhism, you also have many different sects. And
again, this came later, and again, this was done by man, the power of the bees that wants to add to it, to make certain individuals a go-between. And he explained, you go find your tree and sit there and you think on your own. And you think and you think and you think. There was no middleman. He's explaining there is that eternal knowledge that for most of us, when you think of the time that each one has been reincarnating over and over and over and over, we've had to experience everything there is to experience. Now, whether we've understood it, whether we could work with it, that's another question. But the fact of the matter is, all that time, we keep forgetting. We created it. We will get the results eventually. And we are the ones that can have the power to change it. We have that power of choice. If I do not want to be a follower of this, I can decide not to. That is my power of choice. The lower kingdoms don't have that, quote, power of choice. But there is intelligence in those lower kingdoms, and they'll work, as it states, under natural impulses. But there is intelligence there. So his teachings were for each individual. And as was just brought up, even the teachings of the Jesus, again, they're ancient teachings. You go to your house within as I go to mine within. I mean, the hints are all there. It's just that there are those that took it and put power behind it and made changes and rituals, and either you followed it or you didn't belong. Times have changed. We're back to be our own thinker, our own chooser. Yes.
Yes, I'd just like to clarify something stated, is everyone going to a path of a bodhisattva, or is it on certain souls over time will be a bodhisattva? And one more question, would Jesus the Christ be considered a bodhisattva?
Would Jesus the Christ be considered a bodhisattva? Well, number one, this idea of a bodhisattva, as was stated, not everyone is going to, that's not their deed, their path in life. Not everyone. There are those who choose. There are different degrees. One can learn all and have all that development and go to nirvana if one wishes. But then there are those that say, even though I've developed it and I've earned it, I can't just go off into my own that way. I need to help fellow humanity. And we speak of the ancient idea of the Nirmanakaya, who stays to help humanity, even though he has earned that position. It is, again, the choice that is made. And for most individuals, we can say that from what we understand of the philosophy and the ancient philosophies, there is a part of us within us that knows. There's a part of a principle within us that knows what it needs. And we do not say we have a soul. We could lose a soul. The ancient philosophy says we are souls. We are souls in evolution. And it says the soul who has been through all these lifetimes, all these different personalities, it knows what it needs, and it will continue to reincarnate till it can get that full feeling and that bit of perfection. So you don't even have to use the idea of the bodhisattva for the normal man. It's just that we have the capacity and the germs within us to develop and be a universal human altruistic being, living in any one lifetime, but we have to work towards it. Yes.
So we think the philosophy says that perfection is a possibility for each and every soul, but as was said, it's up to each one when that will happen through right effort. But we were thinking in all of the traditions we've heard about in these rooms and what we might call ritual, but what we think is actually a step on the path, it seems there's a point where the seeker must separate themselves, must go off, whether it's mentally or physically. I'm thinking the American Indian traditions where they would go into the woods and reach their animal soul, and the Egyptians, we found out, the initiations were held in the pyramids and so forth. So Siddhartha going off by himself, separating himself from all this wealth and comfort, until he reached enlightenment and then returning, is that a step on this spiritual path for each of us at the appropriate point? Is that necessary?
It sounds very beautiful. It sounds like if each one within their heart could think about it, I would wish to do that. I don't know if I have the capacity, but it would seem that if one really starts on a path in any lifetime, it doesn't matter when, and if he makes it as much as he can part of his lifetime on a daily basis, sure, we might slip and fall, but get up, wipe ourselves off, and let's try it again. We also have to have that idea of have some humor about yourself. We're going to make stupid mistakes in choices all along the line, but somewhere along that line, that little light bulb's gonna go off. That light's gonna come through and we go, I got it. And it's like, you could even keep tabs and marking it off on a scribe, as a scribe does. Each time you learn something that really makes sense, that you can look around and feel it and know it, it's the kind of thing you want to try to let someone else know about this. And a lot of it is done by what another individual sees, not what they read or what they've been told by some authority, but what they see. We've all met people that they just made you feel so calm and relaxed. You could spend hours with them. You might have just walked into a room and just met them, but you're drawn to that individual. This is the calmness. This is that oneness. That's walking that middle path. Not too high, not too low, but to be able to walk the middle, to be able to see things in a fuller light, to make a judgment. Is this correct for me? Is this correct for those? Is this correct for them? Is this correct for all? These are how we have to think, not just what's in it for me. Yes?
So then we hear the path varies with the pilgrim. So we should be warned never to judge another's path. We have no idea where they are in that journey.
That's very true, because who knows what's with deep within their heart? We don't know. We're looking at an outside. We have no idea. So that is if we have to judge, you got one to judge. Judge yourself. Am I harmonious or am I an agitator? Is it 95% of the time, or is it 50% of the time? Can I be high all day, or am I going to fall this way? For most of us, it's always the after thing. I should have said, I should have done, I wish I had gone. It's like there comes a point, there are those who don't have to do all that because they've learned when to do and when not to do. And it can be a joy of learning too, just because the idea of all those that have gone before us that have done it, to say, every great sage, every great master, I too was at the period of development that you are now, right now. But by planning and going year after year, life after life, living a certain way, they get to the point where they gain knowledge and great wisdom. And they're saying, you have that same ability within you. We're all a spark of that one essence, that universal essence. Yes. Oh, did you? Okay.
But when we say that we're not to judge another, we're not saying accept all evils and correct none.
What do you mean by accept all evils and correct none?
Well, if we're in a state where we're accepting passively injustices because we don't want to judge someone else harshly, aren't we in a situation where we're not practicing setting things right?
We would say that the philosophy tells us definitely yes, because the idea of karma, that idea of cause and effect, anything that comes directly in front of our face, it's right there. You cannot turn away. If it comes directly to you, you have an involvement in it. How you decide and choose to act, that's up to you, but you cannot look away. You are involved. So that's a good thing to try to remember as a ruler. Is this coming directly to me, or is this happening across town and I'll have to take so much transportation to get to it? That's one thing. That's a choice you can do. But if something comes directly to you, it's impossible for you to actually turn away from that. That should be a signal. There's something here I'm to learn, or I wouldn't be here at this time. And we know this, for instance, these planes that go up and it crashes and a whole plane full of people are killed. There are those that were either on their way and the car broke down, or some situation came, they were supposed to be on that plane, but for some reason, they couldn't get on that plane. So that individual's karma had nothing to do with the karma of all those that were on that plane. And there's a lot of these situations that you could think about and sort of wonder, maybe it wasn't their time. Yes.
You're mentioning karma, and you know, part of the Eightfold Path is right thought. Part of right thought is right understanding, so that you're contemplating the right thing. So can you help define karma, and does that have anything to do with reincarnation?
Oh. Yes. No, we can do this. No. We speak about karma and the sister doctrine of reincarnation. In other words, we have causes we have set up, not just in this life, but previous lives. And in any one lifetime, you could just pour so much water into a pitcher, right? Afterwards, it's going to overflow. Even if you start putting it in glasses, they overflow. So there's just so much effects in any one lifetime that we can experience. So that the idea of karma and reincarnation go hand in hand. It is the idea that nothing comes to me that I didn't ask for. Every cause has its effect. Everything that's coming to me, good, bad, or indifference, quote, as it goes today, I have to experience. So you could not have causes and effects if you didn't have a vehicle or a motivation to experience the effect from a cause. And that's the idea of reincarnation. And the ancient teachings tell us we have been reincarnating for over, as thinking human beings, 18 million years. That's a lot of different lives and a lot of different experiences, and probably a lot of the same experiences over and over. Some, they catch on right away. Others, takes longer.
So from our conversation this morning, is theosophy Buddhism?
Is theosophy Buddhism? Let's say that it came from the same ancient sources originally. Theosophy is a living philosophy. It's a morals and ethics. So it's of its own. It's part of that ancient teachings. And Buddhism is of its own. But yet we can see that same type fields going out in certain areas. Yes?
I would say Buddhism is one path that as a theosophist we can
take.
HPB embraced Buddhism herself. There are many other religions, and it's up to each of us which of those paths as pilgrims we will choose, whether we choose the path of Jesus or the Buddha or whoever.
And as long as we're willing to try to stick to the basic teachings without all the added and changes made, because there's where you have to start questioning. Even there has been a part in the theosophical history of points where after HPB was gone and William Q. Judge was gone, there were, quote, new leaders, new teachers, that took the two secret doctrines, and I think they have 12 or 13 volumes now, because individuals made changes, made additions, subtractions. So if you can get back to the source of anything with after all the ruffles are gone, then you can see the basic, because in most all religions there are certain symbols that mean the same thing no matter where you're going and where you're at. But the same symbols are basically the same teachings. Only they've been covered up. But when it comes to the idea of symbols, that can give us a hint. They're universal. So we hope that if no one's ever really read The Light of Asia or knows nothing about the story of Siddhartha the Buddha, the Gautama, you might want to look into it and look into some of his teachings and how he approached life in general. That's the way we should approach life in general. That's it. Thank you very much. This is her.
It was extremely clear and well organized.
Well, thank you. We all try.
Well, you succeeded in a lot.
Experience. Oh wow, they're wonderful. They're wonderful. They're doing pretty good.
So the youngest one is the middle school one.
Yeah, she's 10.
10.
My daughter, she's
10 years old.
She's there. She's
there with Mark. Hey, what's up, brother? How you doing? It's always a pleasure. Oh, my goodness. Great. What's up?
Good.
Yeah, long time no see, man. Yeah.
Saw them.